This is a recording of Nancy from Santa Monica, California, taped at the 4th Annual Tulare County Central Office Speaker Meeting Barn Dance, held in Ivanhoe, California, on Saturday, April 17, 1993. In observance with the 11 traditions stating anonymity at the public level, please keep this tape within the fellowship and observe the anonymity of all AA speakers.
Hi, sweetheart, that we met about 1989 up at South Lake Tahoe. She looked like she was part of this country girl from our country. Now she resides in Culver City area. She's got a little bit of limelight. She's been a little bit on TV. She's also become a doctor. The reason we put the Dr. Nancy sign out there was so she could take one of them home with her. All I know is I'd like to ask Dr. Nancy F.
That was me riding in on a horse. Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm a happy, grateful addict and alcoholic. My name is Nancy. I'm a nice little Jewish girl from Boston. I mean, what do I know from barns and country cowboy hats? But I do feel like I fit in here. It's amazing how quickly that happens. I think it has something to do with the Serenity Prayer and hearing the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And when I'm around those, I'm home. Wherever I am, and that's been my experience. I want to thank you all very much for bringing me up here and putting us up for the night and feeding us. And I got to ride a horse. I was supposed to ride a real horse in here, but I guess with the rain and everything, that's not happening. But Larry and Irene brought their horse out here, and I got to ride it around a little bit, and I had a really good time and felt really guilty for all the bad food I've been eating lately because of the poor horse. But I've been having fun, and fun and sobriety is the same that's happening up here, I'll tell you that much. I really love it up here. It is beautiful. You're lucky to be here. When we were driving in, Irene picked us up at the hotel and brought us in, and I felt like I was kind of making that turn from that movie Field of Dreams, and all of a sudden I see my little sign up there that says Dr. Nancy is coming, and I think that's me, and I thought Field of Dreams, I feel like I'm in a field of dreams, and I'm sort of experiencing my dream. This is it. Being around these rooms and working these steps and hanging around with you guys really does make your dreams come true. And I remember when I very first got sober, I think it was one of my first meetings. Afterwards, we all went for coffee for the meeting after the meeting. And somebody said to me, picture yourself 5 years from now and imagine, how you'd like your life to be. And really take your time and really think about the details of it and really picture it. And I don't know really what I dreamt of at that point, but I had my dream, and they said, whatever you just dreamt, you've cheated yourself, because you just can't imagine what this program will bring to you. And I have to say that that has been my experience. It has also been my experience that it hasn't always brought me my dreams in the way that I thought it was going to happen. And a big part of my lesson has been about letting go and letting God. And allowing things to happen in God's time rather than my time. Let me go backwards a little bit, and then hopefully we'll end up back into the present. I started drinking and using drugs. I did both together, and I think this is an AA event, but I can't quite separate drugs from drinking from my own experience. I hope that doesn't offend anyone. But I started actually with hands full of diet pills and booze and pot in high school. I was probably about 14 when I started. And I remember, I think the first thing I started with was smoking a joint. And I remember smoking my first joint and just thinking, I've got to get a lot more of this. Yeah. And that's pretty much what it was like, you know. I have always been a pretty intense person. When I first got sober, they told me to read the big book, and I started reading the big book, and I found it to be very, very boring. And actually, it helped me sleep at night. I'd read the big book before I went to sleep, and I'd fall asleep reading it. But what happened is that I finally got to the part, I think it's the chapter, Into Action, where it says, more than most, we alcoholics lead a double life. And that really fit my experience, because I definitely know how to lead a double life. I know how to look good on the outside and be hurting on the inside, and I know how to not let it show, and I know how to have a job and be responsible and show up for work and be absolutely drunk on my ass right up until about an hour before I have to show up somewhere. And so I'm really good at this double life thing. So when I read that, I was like, that was the thing that I really identified with. And that's pretty much how my life went. I did really well in school. I went to school. You know, I know a lot of us don't do that. I went to high school and I went to college. And I was lucky because I had started working when I was 12 at a camp for physically disabled kids. And I knew early on that that's the kind of work that I wanted to do, was working with these kids. And I met a kid there that was about my age who had muscular dystrophy. His name was Jimmy. And we became very, very close. And he's been a big inspiration for me for my life, because he was one of these people who had a lot of problems, physical problems, but he had an incredible attitude, and it didn't stop him from trying anything. And he was a big inspiration for me. So I had my direction and my professional thing all set up, and then I started drinking and using when I was about 14. From the time I started drinking and using, I used pretty much every single day. And I definitely was loaded every single day of high school. I graduated high school as a class officer. I was in National Honor Society. I won a lot of scholarships and awards. So I really had that double life thing down. And at the same time, I was working toward working with physically disabled. And the one time I did get sober for a little bit when I was in high school was I was sitting in English class, and there was a girl in front of me who started talking to me about stuff. And she helped me get clean for a short period of time. I became a born-again Christian. And that's kind of funny because I was raised Jewish. And it's, you know, it's funny, but it isn't funny. You know, it's like, it shows you that even back then, for me, you know, there was some kind of spiritual journey going on, and that it was about, recovery for me had to be about some kind of spiritual recovery. That was the only thing that was going to work. And I actually did achieve some period of sobriety during that couple of months or whatever it was. But what happened was my mother caught me with a cross and said, "Don't you know that's the start of the Hitler Youth movements in, you know, in America, and that's how it all began in Germany?" And that was the end of my born again Christian time. So I went back to drinking and using. I also was a blackout. What else do you do, right? Seemed right to me. I was a blackout drinker from the very beginning, and I loved blacking out. That was why I drank. That was part of why I drank. It wasn't why I drank. One of the things that I loved about using was that it took off the intensity. I'm a very, very intense person. I experience life with a lot of intensity. Whether it's great joy or great sadness or great anything, for me it's not about the in-betweens. I do tend to be, you know, one of these typically alcoholic, extreme kind of intense people. And what drugs and alcohol did for me was it took the edge off. And I like that. But the other thing that I liked is that I figured if you couldn't remember what you did the night before, then you couldn't be responsible for it. So that gave me a lot of license to do all kinds of things under the guise of drinking. And I really just liked it a lot. I tried everything that was around during my time. anyway, I went on to college, and I stopped using drugs from that time that I was a born-again Christian. I actually only went back to alcohol. I decided it was the drugs that I was out of control with, but I could handle my drinking. So I drank through college. I pretty much drank every single day in college. I had a routine down. I ran track and cross-country in college. And I had it all worked out to hustle pitchers of beer by racing guys around the bar. And, you know, we go outside, have a race, and get my pitchers of beer. And we had which place to go on which night. It was all very organized. I was in a sorority. So there was a lot of, you know, a lot of that kind of drinking. And if any of you saw the movie Animal House, that is exactly what my college days were like. Exactly. That is absolutely no exaggeration at all. I mean, we had giant food fights. We had, Kappa Sigma was the Animal House of my campus, and they made this stuff called cuckoo juice. And we'd all go up there to their house, and we'd have these cuckoo juice parties, and they were made in these big barrels, and I don't know what was in it, but I know that one night I crawled home on my hands and knees, which a few blocks away, you know, because I woke up the next day and my knees are all scraped and my palms are all gone. And I didn't remember because I was a blackout drinker. I just knew on Sunday mornings everybody was mad at me and I didn't know why, you know, and because I'd been drinking. And I guess I was pretty obnoxious when I was drunk. But I always felt like, oh, well, I was drunk. What do you expect? What happened was that my relationship with my friend Jimmy also grew stronger through the years, and I got involved in doing a lot of stuff with him for creating opportunities for physically disabled people who ordinarily, when they would go to, when they finished public school, like high school, most of those guys went to either a nursing home or they went to live with their parents. Back then, there really weren't very many opportunities to live independently. So I had been involved in helping start this thing called Boston Center for Independent Living with Jimmy and a few of his friends. And now there are centers for independent living all over the country. And what they do is they provide assistance, personal care assistance, and that kind of thing to help people live independently. And I got really involved in that, and I got really close to Jimmy. And I actually fell in love with him. But it wasn't very cool back then to be in love with somebody who was physically disabled. And we never really said a whole lot to each other about it. We just hung out together a lot whenever we could. And in my senior year of college, I went back to Boston to spend the holiday, and then I was going to go to work at an internship at Boston Children's Hospital. And Jimmy was living in Boston at the time, and I went to see him. We spent New Year's Eve together and finally kind of admitted that we had feelings for each other that were romantic and had decided that we were going to try living together and see if that worked out and if, you know, if we could handle it. And if so, then we were going to move in and then maybe get married. And I remember thinking that night, I'm not going to drink anymore, because he didn't really drink, because he said, I've already lost so much control over my body, I don't want to lose any more by drinking. And I thought, oh, that's right, you know, and he's so into living life to the fullest, you know, I'll hang out with him and together we'll save the world of disabled people together, and, you know, nothing grandiose about me. And, you know, we had all these plans, and I remember feeling like everything made sense. Like, I had this great clarity of what my life was about and what my purpose was, and, I don't know, it was just this wonderful feeling. And what happened is, 10 days later, he died. And when that happened, I felt like the wrong person died. Like I should have been the one to die, because I was the rascal, and I was the one that was always getting into, you know, mischief. And he had all these great ideas, and I know he still had a lot of work to do and plans, and he was a good person. And I couldn't understand why he died and I lived. And what helped me a lot with that was whiskey. So what I started doing was a bottle of whiskey every night. And I'd go do whatever I had to do during the day, but every night I fell asleep with the whiskey. And I just passed out with the whiskey, that's what it was. And just really got into a pretty big depression and read everything I could read on death and dying. Kubler-Ross had come out at that time with a book on death and dying and all that stuff and stages of grief. And I read everything. And ironically, at that time, I had started to do an internship for my senior year. and it was about working on a leukemia unit, a children's leukemia unit. So here I was working with these kids that were dying and their family members and thinking about Jimmy everywhere I went and not understanding why he had died. And he was just such a hopeful, inspiring kind of person. It just didn't make sense. So it definitely, I found out later in learning about alcoholism that for many of us women, our drinking tends to really take a giant step on the increase after the loss of someone. And that definitely was my case. I definitely greatly increased the amount that I was drinking when I lost Jimmy. And I just wanted to die. I became very suicidal. Everywhere I went, all I thought about was dying so that I could be with him. You know, if I was standing here, I'd be thinking about how I could hang a rope from the rafters. Everywhere I went, it was just thoughts of how I could die. And eventually I got sick, and I believe that we do that. You know, I believe that if you think something strongly enough, you know, our body does respond. And that's what happened. I got physically ill, and I collapsed at work, and I was hospitalized, and I was pretty sick. And my brother came to see me. I have two older brothers, and I have one that I'm particularly close to. His name is also Jimmy. And he came to see me in the hospital, and he said, you know, if Jimmy were alive, he wouldn't want you living like this. This is not the way, the example that he set. And it made sense to me, and it was suddenly I kind of got things back in order, and I had my perspective, and I thought, okay, I've got to live for Jimmy. So it was sort of like not about me, it was about him. Sometimes when I share my story, I feel like it's as much about codependence, you know, and an Al-Anon story as it is an AA story, because it really, there's a lot of that in there. Anyway, I managed to get better, and I went to work, and I ended up eventually working at a rehab hospital on a unit for, I worked half-time on a unit for people who had strokes or brain tumors, and the other half-time on a unit for people who had spinal cord injuries, had broken their necks or backs, and were now paralyzed. And I was a recreational therapist. My job was to teach these people how to live a full and happy life in spite of being physically disabled. And my way of being normal, right, is drinking and using, right, partying. That's what's normal. So we had this van, and I called it the Happy Van, and I would wheel all my patients up into this van, and we'd go to the Red Sox games, and we'd go to the Bruins games, and we had a favorite bar in the north end of Boston called Number 4. For those of you who are hockey fans, that was after Bobby Orr. It was Bobby Orr's bar. And anytime we'd come wheeling in, you know, everybody'd welcome us and give us free drinks, and, you know, oh, these poor guys are in wheelchairs, let's give them free drinks, you know, and we'd smoke dope out in the back, and just get them completely wasted. And most of these guys, especially the spinal cord injury guys, were us. They were people like us. They had gotten drunk at a party, and they were not as lucky as we are sitting here, and they had dove into the shallow end of the swimming pool or fallen downstairs and broken their necks. You know, all of them had drunk. That's how they had broken their necks, was through being drunk. So they loved to drink, and it was normal for them to drink. And in exchange, they'd give me their little bottles of pills. They had all these wonderful muscle relaxers and tranquilizers. So here I was in Boston, you know, my medicine cabinet looked like, you know, the Boston telephone directory, you know, with Kennedy and O'Sullivan and Whalen and, you know, all those good Boston names, and all little pill bottles, and I'd be wheeling them up, and we'd be going here, and we'd be going there, and everything was about drinking and using. And then one day my boss came to me and said, Nancy, we're going to start an alcoholism unit here in the hospital, and I'm going to transfer you to be the recreational therapist for this unit. Now, you have to understand, my picture of alcoholics at that point, I mean, I had no idea that I was one. I had no idea, really, even that these guys that I was working with were alcoholics. I mean, we were just being normal, having fun. I mean, the whole idea was to help them be normal. And my idea of being, you know, I could outdrink anybody. That was my theory. I really felt I could outdrink anybody and still stand. I mean, I had lots of shot glasses and T-shirts that I had won at various bars, proving how well I could drink. And that's normal. Like, as long as I was making my grades and as long as I had my job and showed up for work every day, I was normal. My picture of alcoholics were people who got violent with each other, who were the derelicts, the street people. You know, that was my picture of an alcoholic. And I was afraid of working with alcoholics. And I told her so. I said, you know, I don't think I'd be very good at working with those people. I'm actually a little afraid of those people. I don't really want to do that. And she said, I don't know, Nancy. Somehow I think you'd be really good working with those people. So I said, okay, well, I'll give it a try. And I went to work on this unit, and what happened is I loved you guys. You know, we got along really well. It was like instant click. But there was one small problem. There was a poster on our one of the group therapy rooms, and the poster had these frosty mugs of beer, and it said, if you drink a lot of beer, you drink a lot. And this was a big problem for me because on the way home from work every night, I was stopping off at the wholesale liquor store and buying my case of Molson's Golden Ale to go with my whiskey. I don't know if you guys remember Boilermakers. I don't know if that's still popular, but that was one of my favorites. And, you know, so I was doing that every day, so I was drinking a lot of beer, but I don't drink a lot because I can handle it, and I'm normal. So I couldn't make sense of the poster, so I decided I was going to have a little chit-chat with the program director, who was in AA. And I went up to him and I said, listen, you got a great program here. You're doing a really good job and I like working with you, but there's one problem. And I told him about the poster. I said, you really ought to take that down because it's not true for everyone. For example, I drink a lot of beer, but I don't drink a lot. See how you guys are looking at me? That's how he looked at me. He was like, uh-huh. So he said, you know, Nancy, maybe you should go to a couple of these AA meetings and just sort of learn a little bit more about alcoholism and meet more alcoholics and just see what you think. And I said, it's a very good idea. That's what I'm going to do. And I never went because I didn't want you to think I was one of you guys, you know. So I never went. And what ended up happening is that I went to a conference in Florida and got offered a job in Hawaii and doing basically the same thing as a recreational therapist, half-time on a transitional living program and half-time on an alcoholism program. And the funny thing is, you know, you think, for those of us who have done geographics, you know, we think if we move, we'll start off fresh and new, and somehow, like, our old self won't come with us. But guess what it does? You know, I bring me wherever I go. And I went to Hawaii, and I did exactly the same job. They had a van there, and these guys talked a little different. You know, they were Hawaiian, but they basically had the same pills and the same booze and a little bit better pot. And Hakalolo. Oh, boy. It got really bad there. I had one more year of drinking at that point. That was 1979, and I really did it. I mean, I really got loaded. I got involved with patients there. I mean, sexually involved with patients. Like, it's a big no-no. You're not supposed to do these things. And that was part of my drinking behavior. I did a lot of things in that last year of drinking and using that nice little Jewish girls from Boston don't do. There's a line in the big book that talks about the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that happens to us. And I just want to tell you that I qualify by virtue of that line. We checked into the hotel today, and there's a big convention there of ham radio operators. And I went down to the gift shop to look for something. Larry was up in the room, and I went down to through the lobby to look for something in the gift shop. And as I'm walking down, first there's a guy in the elevator, and he's like, you know, checking it out. And then we're walking through, hey, how you doing? What's happening? And I thought to myself, boy, if this were the old days, you know. And it's funny how that thinking stays with you, you know, and you just kind of, it's really bad, you know, it's really like that. The very first time I walked in, I went to Atlantic City when they made it into a gambling thing, you know, with all the casinos. And the first time I went in, I had to go out. It was so stimulating, re-stimulating for me of my old days, of just that whole kind of environment. You know, it was like, should I have a Visa card in my pocket? You know, I can go buy myself some nice earrings and a really nice dress and some high heels, and I'll be in business, you know. And, yeah. Hard to do that stuff sober, thank God. But anyway, that last year of drinking, it was pretty bad, and I got in trouble for the very first time at work. I had always been able to keep those two separate, you know, those two lives very separate. And what started happening in that last year is that there was a lot of crossover. I also have always been into sports, and I had run a couple of marathons in Hawaii, and I would get up, and I'd smoke a little dope and go run, and then have a couple of beers, and then I worked like 12 to 9, and then go into work on an alcoholism unit, counseling you alcoholics. Oh, and by the way, I didn't tell you this, that I got so good at counseling you guys that they made me a full-time counselor on the alcoholism program. So, it was really crazy. It was really crazy. And I started discovering, you know, the pills. The pills were good because you couldn't smell the pills, you know, so I could show up around you guys and at least you wouldn't smell it. And what happened is I got confronted at work about my behavior. They really didn't know what was going on. They just knew that something was wrong. By now, one of the guys that I had worked with in Boston had moved out and was living with me. And he was a violent, he was a junkie who had overdosed and was left on the street for dead. His friends thought he was dead. And he had a lack of oxygen to the spinal cord and ended up in a wheelchair. Anyway, that's the kind of addict he was. He came out and we were living together in this nice, healthy relationship that only we can find. And there was all kinds of craziness with him. He had a big knife, and it was crazy. I'll just put it that way. I was stealing his supply, and I didn't really have to, but I was, you know, and he was just constantly out of drugs because I was constantly taking them. And it was just pretty crazy. And getting confronted at work, I pretty much almost lost my job. And things were getting pretty crazy. And there was this guy there that worked there who was one of these old AA kind of guys. And he pulled me into his office and he said, "Nancy, I don't know what's going on, but something, you've got a secret, and I don't know what it is, but there's something so wrong that you feel like you can't tell anybody what it is." And at this point, you know, my denial was so strong, I really didn't know what was wrong. And all I could think about was that back in high school, I had gotten into a little bit of trouble from using drugs too much, and maybe the drugs were catching up with me again. So I told him, "Well, you know, I've been smoking a little too much pot lately, maybe that's it." That was really as honest as I could be. I really believed that's what it was. So he said, "Well, go home tonight and don't smoke pot." And I was so pissed at him. I thought, you know, doesn't he understand? I need much more than that. I need a golden key. I need some kind of magic that's going to make my life better. And I had kind of gone back to my suicidal thinking. I kept thinking I needed to just check out. I needed to just get out of this life. And I didn't know there was any way out. All I could think of was if I could just die, then I wouldn't have to keep on this roller coaster thing. The other thing about being loaded all the time was always having to look over your shoulder, you know, and remember what you told who, and the chase of constantly keeping the supply going and covering up the stories and trying to look like you're okay when you're not okay, and you know, just that constant chase, which I'm so grateful I don't have to deal with anymore today. And anyway, I went home every night that week. It was Christmas to New Year's, and I didn't smoke dope. And I thought, wow, you know, this is amazing. And I went home, then it was New Year's Eve, and New Year's Eve was my night to dedicate to Jimmy by getting completely wasted. And I worked that night. I got home about 1 o'clock. I had taken all you guys to a meeting and an AA celebration, New Year's celebration, and I dropped you all off at the treatment center. And I came home, and I know there was a couple of bottles of wine and some other booze, and I know there was some Thai stick, and I think I smoked some heroin that night, and I know there was probably a few dozen Valium. I'm not really too sure. I was doing a lot of Valium at that point. All I know is that I have one spotty memory of smoking some dope with a bunch of local guys at a beach in Honolulu. And the next thing I knew, I woke up sitting opposite one of you, counseling you, one of my patients, counseling Henry Y. I'll never forget him. I came to sitting across the desk from him, talking to him about staying sober and living life naturally. That's when I started to get a clue that there was probably something wrong, and it probably had to do with booze. That really was about the beginning. But even when I first got sober, I really didn't think I was an alcoholic. What happened was the following. There was one Narcotics Anonymous meeting a week on the island of Oahu, and I went to it. It was a Sunday night, and that was like a Wednesday or Thursday. I went to that meeting, and I walked into the NA. It was my first NA meeting. I walked in, and I immediately felt at home. I looked around, and I thought, I could see any one of these guys lighting up a joint. I could see myself smoking with any of you. And I thought, wow, I feel really comfortable here. But I didn't want you to know, because I was this counselor at the one treatment program we had on the island. I was pretty well known as somebody who was like supposed to be on the therapy side, not on the patient side, you know. And so people came up to me and said, oh, how you doing, and all that stuff. And I was like, get the fuck away from me. You know, I didn't want to talk to anyone. I could be very, very hostile, and I could keep you away with one look. I mean, it did not take a lot of effort to keep you away from me. And that's pretty much how I was in meetings in the beginning. I was very, very hostile because I didn't want you to ask me any questions. I didn't want you to think I was there for me. I told people I was there so that I could learn more about this disease so I could be a better counselor. And finally, about 2 or 3 weeks into it, I had met this woman in NA, and she took me to lunch, and she started asking me about my drink. Oh, I said something about my drinking. Oh, I know what happened. I was drinking during this time of going to the NA meetings, and probably was a good thing now that I think about it, because I probably would have had even worse withdrawals than I had, because I cold turkeyed off the Valium and the tie stick and the heroin and the whatever else there was. But I did it by drinking. So I've been drinking during these couple of weeks, and I went to lunch with her, and she said, you mean you've been, oh, what happened was I had this other friend who lived in California, and he would come out every once in a while, and we'd just party, and it was the last day that he was going to be in town, and it was raining, and there was nothing to do, so I said, let's go buy some whiskey, and we'll make some nice Irish coffee, and just stay home and cuddle and, you know, do that. He said, okay, and we went to the liquor store, and I bought whiskey, and I went for the big jug of whiskey, because I knew he was leaving that night, and I was going to need my whiskey. And he said, you know, you mentioned that you were trying to cut down on your drinking. And I thought, who the hell is he? You know, I don't remember saying I was going to cut down on my drinking, and don't tell me what size bottle to buy. You know, I was pissed. Anyway, we buy the whiskey, and we come home, and of course I stash my bottle away for later. And he left that night. And I went immediately to the cabinet, and I got out the whiskey bottle, and I'm standing at the kitchen sink, and I raised the bottle to my lips, and I hear him saying in my mind, you said you were trying to cut down. And I poured the whiskey down the sink. And that was February 24th, 1980, and I have not been drunk or loaded since that day, one day at a time. Through today. So, you know, I do believe that there's a higher power, because I know that my higher power got me sober, because I could not have poured that whiskey down. There was no way I could pour whiskey down the sink. No way. And I was telling my friend this, that I'd met at Narcotics Anonymous, about the story, and she said, you mean you've been drinking all this time? And I said, yeah, of course I've been drinking. This is Narcotics Anonymous. I'm just not doing narcotics. And she said, tell me a little bit more about your drinking. So I started bragging to her. You know, telling her all the drinking contests I won and the shot glasses I had and all this stuff. And she said, you know, Nancy, I think you're an alcoholic. And I said, you know what? If you think I'm an alcoholic, I'll be an alcoholic. I don't care. Okay, I'm an alcoholic. What do I do? She said, go to some AA meetings, you know, and listen for yourself this time instead of for your patients. And it started seeping in, but what I have to tell you is that my first 8 months of sobriety, I was pretty out of it. I really didn't know what was going on. I quit my job because I felt like, how could I get sober and be working at the only treatment center on the island? So I quit that, and basically what happened was AA became my treatment center. I went to 2 meetings a day, and where I got sober, there was this really dumpy Alano Club on a pier in Honolulu. It's not even there anymore because it got condemned and they took it away. But it was really gross, you know, but it was very warm. And there was a sign on the wall and it said, I am responsible. When anyone anywhere reaches out for AA, I want the hand of AA to be there. For that I am responsible. And that was one of the first lessons that I learned in AA, because I got involved in a home group called the Malia Discussion Group, and then on Thursday nights in Honolulu. And it was a very local group. I didn't go where the Howleys, that's the white people, where they went. I went with the locals. And it was really wonderful because by now I had kind of a chip on my shoulder, because I didn't tell you, but I had started working on my master's degree during that last year of drinking. So here was the double life. I was working at a hospital looking like I had it together, and at the same time starting work on my master's degree in psychology because I wanted to be a better therapist, and at the same time being loaded and having my other profession at nighttime. And when I got sober, I went to this group, Malia, and the people there, you know, most of them could hardly read and write, but they spoke so much from the heart. And they told me, you know, that my education wasn't going to get me anywhere, that I had to be in service if I wanted to stay sober, and that service starts behind the broom. And they said, I may know a lot of stuff, but I don't know anything about sobriety and recovery. And if I wanted to learn, I had a chance if I took the cotton out of my ears and stuck it in my mouth. And they told me that, you know, if God wanted me to talk more than listen, he would have given me 2 miles in 1 ear. And they told me that winners sit in the first 3 rows, and that not in the dare me to get sober seats in the back or out the door. And they told me to be of service, and they told me to have a pack of people that I hung around with, so that if I was missing for a couple of days, people would call and ask where I was and know that I wasn't around. And they told me to work the steps. And they told it to me in ways I could understand. And it really took that. It took some very simple folk wisdom to touch me. You know, because I was actually, even though I kind of came on like I was this big educated person, I really was very, very scared. Because I thought I was going to die. And I thought if I didn't die, I was going to be put in one of those padded cells. You know, remember that song, They're Coming to Take You Away? Remember that? That song used to scare the hell out of me when I would hear it, because I really thought that they were going to someday come and take me away. I mean, I knew I was nuts. And I was especially nuts when I was loaded. I mean, I was crazy. Nothing stopped me when I was loaded. And I just knew I was going to get taken away one day. And so it was a strange mixture of, like, stay away from me. I don't want to talk to anyone. I don't want you to be nice to me. I don't want anything. And totally absorbing everything you had to say and trying to follow it. And that was the beginning of my sobriety. Also at the beginning of my sobriety, I guess I was still working at this time, there was a guy known as Big Richard who was pretty active, kind of a local guru in Honolulu AA. And he was about 6 foot, I don't know, 4, 6 foot 6. And he must have weighed 400 pounds if he weighs an ounce. And this big local guy, his head alone is like the size of a buffalo, you know. And I went up, I brought up this, there was a local guy I'd been working with, one of my clients, and I brought him up to meet Big Richard. I thought they would connect, you know. And Big Richard sent him for a cup of coffee and looked down at me and said, how are you, baby? And I looked up at him, and it was the first person that I think I had looked in the eyes probably since Jimmy had died. And I just started to cry. And he said, you come with me. And I went with him to the meeting after the meeting. And he sat down and he just started teaching me about AA. And he kind of took me under his wing. And it was just like the odd couple, you know, because here was I, this little white girl from Boston, and him, this big brown man, big, you know. And he had quite a story. And I used to feel like he, you know, people were thinking that he was my pimp. I mean, that's kind of how it looked. And I was so afraid. And I was so afraid of him. I just knew what he wanted, and I knew it wasn't about sobriety, you know. And I had a moped at the time. That's how I got around. I got it mixed up. I thought it was a Harley Davidson. And he knew I got pretty crazy when I got on that thing. And so he'd make me take rides to meetings with him. And I'd sit in the car with my hands on the door handle, just waiting for him to make one false move, you know. And like, not like anyone would really want me at that time. I mean, I was a mess. I was bloated and I was red and I was, you know, disgusting. You know how we get from our using. And he didn't, though. He was just 100% love, AA kind of love, you know. And he really was, it just choked me up to talk about him because he just helped me so much. And I think God knew that it would take somebody like that to get my attention. You know, I was a little bit afraid of him and a little bit embarrassed by him, but his words just made so much sense. And you know, he said so many things. You know, he used to say, I looked for my God, so I climbed the highest steeple. And God said, get down, my child, for I dwell among the people. And he had a million of those. You know, I can't remember all of them. I wish I could. But he just had a million of those, you know. And he just, whatever the situation was, he just seemed to know what to say and how to say it. And I really, really owe him so much because he kept me coming back. He told me what meetings to go to, and he told me about sticking with the pack. And he told me about sticking with women. It was funny because it came from him, but I asked him to be my sponsor, and he said, no, I don't sponsor women. You need a woman sponsor. And I was afraid of women. I didn't know how really, you know, to deal with women. Women were competition, and women were trouble, and I knew how to deal with you men, you know. And it was clear. And you know, I started learning all this stuff and the service. That was important. And they taught me about the AA logo. And I like to talk about this because a lot of people don't talk about this anymore. You know, our circle with the triangle in it. And they told me that the three points of the triangle are the three legacies, you know, of AA, unity, recovery, and service. And that unity is about the group and having a group of people to hang with so that you know, people notice if you're missing, and so that, you know, just, it's easier to stay sober together. You know, the first step starts with we. It doesn't say I, you know. We admitted we were powerless. And so the pack and unity was important. And then service, they told me, you know, always have some service work going. Whatever it is, just always be in service. And then you have a chance and you're out of yourself. And you have a chance of staying sober. And then recovery was working the 12 steps. And then they told me about the 12 things that are associated with each legacy. Like for unity, there's the 12 traditions. For recovery, there's the 12 steps. And we have an AA service manual, and it has 12 concepts in it. And a lot of people don't know about that anymore. And I think it's important to talk about that stuff and take a look at it. I have a business, you know, I'm self-employed. And those 12 concepts, you know, really amazingly apply to work situations really well. And it's a great way to run an organization. And, you know, I encourage you to take a look at that stuff because it's really wonderful stuff. And in my first year of sobriety, I kind of lost everything. I was somebody who had a job and I had wheels and I had all that stuff coming into the program, and I lost it all after I got sober for a variety of reasons. As I said, I quit my job. And I kept trying to get work, and I kept not happening. And so I was collecting unemployment. I had absolutely no money. I moved out from Living with Flame. That was the name of the guy that had the knife. Flame. It kind of gives you the idea of the kind of guy he was. Yeah. And, yes, a real man. Yeah. And, I moved out from him, and I was living in this cruddy place, and I went through withdrawals there. You know, I was itching, and I saw things crawling on the walls, and I had nightmares. But little by little, I kept hanging around and started getting a little bit better. And about 8 months into this, I woke up, and I really didn't know I had been asleep all the time. So if you're new, you know, just keep coming back because it's just amazing what starts happening. And about 8 months into it, I went to this meeting, and we used to all go to this AA beach after the meeting. We went to the beach, and this guy, Johnny O, was talking. He's one of my favorite people. He really helped me get my first, second, and third step the first time around. because he said he had just signed a lease on an apartment and he was just with a new lady. And he said, you know, I know I can sign this lease, but it doesn't guarantee at all that I'm going to be here for 12 months. And I can think I'm going to, but if God's really in charge, God will decide how long I'm going to be in this place. He said, and I know that the answer to any problem I have in my life is to think about God and to let God run my life. But I just can't seem to keep God there, and I wish I could. I wish I could think about God the way I do when I first fall in love. You know how when you first fall in love, all you can do is think about that person, and everywhere you go and everything you do, you think of that person, and you think, oh, you want to share that with that person. And he said, if I could just think about God that way, you know I'd be so much better off. And I was sitting there on the beach, you know, in the fog of early sobriety, and I heard that. And I thought, Tinas, you know, you have nothing else going on. You don't have anybody you're living with, or there's no romantic interest. You're not working. I was taking the bus everywhere. I'd gotten into an accident with the moped and destroyed it. And so I had a lot of time on my hands to think about God. And so that's what I started doing. I started pretending that God was my new boyfriend. And I really did this everywhere I went. I pretended I'd leave my hand kind of next to my side and, you know, pretend I was walking hand in hand with God. And, you know, Hawaii is so beautiful. And I'd look at the mountains and the rainbows and I'd think, God, you really did a beautiful job on that. I'm so glad you're here with me so we can enjoy this together. And when I get on the bus, I kind of move over a little bit on the seat so he could sit with me. And I really just thought about God all the time. And what started to happen for me is my life started to change. Things just started feeling better. And it wasn't like the outside stuff changed. It wasn't like, oh, I got $1 million and bought a place and, you know, it wasn't like that. It was just that I started feeling better and I started feeling more connected to you and to the world. And then I saw that movie, Oh God, Book 2, where the little girl does an ad campaign for God. And the whole thing was, thank God, thank God, thank God. And that sort of matched what I was trying to do. And then one day somebody was driving me to the beach and we turned a corner and there was this big brick wall and someone had spray painted Thank God on the wall. And it was like all these coincidences started happening and I started to really think that maybe God was listening and that it was personal and it wasn't just this thing that we create because we're afraid. You know, which is sort of how I had thought about God before. I was kind of an agnostic, like maybe he exists, but maybe it's just sort of a safe way to think when you're not sure what's out there. And suddenly I started feeling like maybe there was more to it than that, and that there really was a God, and he really might not be too busy for me. And all I can tell you is it was a feeling on the inside. It wasn't like all these magical things started suddenly clearing up. Eventually, I had a series of really weird jobs, you know. I was Miss Icy at one point. I went around with this kid that dressed in a bear costume. I was Miss Icy and I drove this big red Buick LeSabre convertible and, we'd drive around and give out balloons and free coupons for Icy Bear, you know, and I mean, just these horrible jobs. Pretty soon, at first I thought, oh, isn't this wonderful working with children, bringing happiness everywhere? You know, and pretty soon the kids are like trying to unzip the Icy Bear's costume, and, you know, they're like grabbing at the balloons, and I'm like, get away, you know. And we got bought out by that company, so that job ended. And one job after another, I ended up being really, really broke. I lived on rice and unemployment checks, and I mean, things were pretty tough for me in my first year of sobriety. I remember one time I went to a meeting and for some reason the check didn't come. I had no money, I had nothing, like I had rice to eat and that was it. And someone invited me to go to coffee after the meeting and I'm like, of course I'm not going to tell you what was going on, right? Because we don't want to do that. So I didn't say anything and she invited me to coffee and I said, no thanks, you know, I got something to do, right? Like I have something to do. And she said, no, come on, my treat, I insist. And I'm like, okay. And she, in the course of the coffee, she slid a $10 bill across the table to me and said, look, I know you're hurting right now and you could use this. And I'm like, no, I can't take that because I don't know when I can pay you back. I mean, I really didn't know when I'd be able to pay somebody $10 back. That to me would be like $10,000 today or something. And she told me to take the money and that one day there would be some other newcomer who was really hurting and really needed $10, and at that time I should give them the $10, you know. And that would, we kind of keep the message going that way too. And I know that AA isn't about just being handed money, but I'll tell you, that day was really, it really saved me, you know, and it showed me another part of who you are and how you understand and how I wasn't well enough to say how bad I was hurting and what was going on with me, but you helped me anyway. And I have a million stories of ways that you guys have helped like that. In my second year of sobriety, I got sick, physically ill, and something went wrong with my kidneys, and I had to have a surgery, and then the surgery didn't go well, and like I nearly died. Like people were coming in the room crying, and I was too weak to say anything. I could just sort of see them floating in and floating out. And I learned how to stay sober through that. I had incredible pain for about a year and a half. I had an open wound. I couldn't work. I couldn't lift a laundry basket. I couldn't cook for myself. And you all came and brought me meals, and I would stay in bed so that the one thing I could do all day, if I rested enough during the day, I could stand through a meeting. I couldn't sit. I had to be lying down or standing up. And, you know, people would pick me up and drive me to meetings. And they told me I had to be in service. And what happened is I got really angry during that time because I figured, hey, I cleaned up and I was working my steps. And I was following your directions, and now I'm sick, and I'm going to have to live my life this way. You know, and I'm an athlete. I like to work out, and I couldn't do that. And I got really suicidal and really angry and really hostile. And you were coming up to me and going, 3-11, Nats, 3-11. I was like, fuck you. And, you know, I wanted to picture you with a giant hole in your side and then tell me about 3-11, you know. I just was not very gracious about being sick. And it got worse and worse, and I got more and more depressed and more hostile and more angry and more hopeless. And what eventually happened is one of you guys invited me over to your house and gave me a book. And it's not AA conference-approved literature, but it's a book that a lot of us have read. It's called The Search for Serenity by Louis Presnell. And in that book, there's a thing on self-pity. And the guy that handed me the book said, Nancy, just read this book. This book changed my life. Maybe there's something in here for you. And I said, you know, Greg, it's going to take more than a goddamn book to make me feel better. You know, I was so angry. But I took the book because you've taught me to do it anyway. I don't have to have a good attitude doing this program. I don't have to like it. I just show up, I sit down, I work the steps. I don't have to like what's going on. So I took the book, I opened it up, I started reading, and my life completely changed. My life has not been the same since that night. And what I read in this book is, they were talking about how sometimes in life you're in a situation which appears hopeless, and you start to feel sorry for yourself, and you start to feel angry, and you go into this vicious cycle of anger and hopelessness and frustration and self-pity. And it said this thing, and I can never say it as well as the book itself says it, but it said that when you may ask yourself, why is this happening to me? And I was definitely there. I was saying, why is this happening to me? And the book said, when you ask that question, you're assuming that you are the center of the universe and that everything that happens to you is supposed to be all about you. And for me, that was like a lightning bolt experience, because all of a sudden I realized that I am not the center of the universe. And I had this flash where I saw this giant machine, and I'm not at all mechanical, but I had pictured this machine with all these gears, and each gear was turning another gear, and that by each gear locking into the other gear, it kind of kept the whole machine moving. And I had this flash, and I heard this voice, and it said, you're just a cog in the wheel. And your job is to keep your cog clean so that you can meet the other cogs and the whole thing can keep going. And the book said something like that. You know, it probably didn't say it like that, but it said, you know, you're not the center of the universe, and things that happen may not be anything about you. And my sponsor was always telling me that my life was none of my business, and I did not understand that at all. What do you mean it's none of my business? It's happening to me, you know. And I started to understand, you know, that it just was none of my business, that I didn't know why I had this kidney thing, and I didn't know when it was going to get better or if it was going to get better, and that basically it was none of my business, and that what I should do is focus on gratitude and service. And if I just paid attention to that, that was my business, and that was my purpose in life. I am not the center of the universe. I am just a part of. And so I started being a part of again, and what I did is I organized, I got into service. I organized a no-booze cruise from my bedside, and I started collecting newcomers' phone numbers at meetings and calling people because I could be on the phone lying down. And I just started pretending that the thing was already healed, even though I didn't know when it was going to happen or if it was going to happen. And I just started throwing myself into service and acting grateful for the thing being healed, even though it wasn't. And it didn't heal up right away, like I don't have this magical thing, like one day I woke up and it was gone. It wasn't like that, but it was like I just started feeling better. And again, you know, that's kind of how it's been for me, you know. I'm one of the educational variety they talk about in the big book. My spiritual experiences are not flat lightning bolt kind of experiences. They're just, I work at it, I get really angry and I get really hostile and I get really frustrated and I complain a lot. And then somebody tells me something and I go off and I do it and I do it and I do it and pretty soon things start to change. It's never like quick. But I ended up having another surgery. I ended up having horrible treatments, a lot of physical pain. I didn't get strung out. I didn't use narcotics through any of that. I learned how to manage pain through meditation and music. And, you know, there's all kinds of other wonderful things besides just the 12 steps that we can start taking advantage of once we, you know, clean out our clogged drains. That's kind of how I think about it. And that was another part for me of not just steps 2 and 3, but also being of service. And along through the years, you know, I was doing my steps, my fourth, my fifth. I did a number of inventories. I did a couple of inventories I want to talk about. One they talk about in the 12 and 12, which is in a relationship inventory. And there's a series of questions, like a whole paragraph of questions about relationships. And I wrote down every relationship. This is male-female relationships. Starting with my brothers and my father, all the way through, like, stranger number 101, you know, and did that kind of an inventory and answered all those questions. And that inventory was a really powerful experience for me and really helped me understand that I am not in charge, that God is in charge, and that that's what my life has to be about. And I forget that all the time. I just heard myself say it and thought about ways that I wasn't doing it right now. But, you know, I guess that's what we're all here for, is to keep growing. And I did a lot of fifth steps. I did another really important inventory on my parents where I got a really great thing. Somebody turned me on to another book called The Ten Commandments by Emmett Fox. He wrote another book, Sermon on the Mount, which a lot of us in program have read. And, boy, it's just terrific stuff. And the thing about the Ten Commandments that helped me a lot was that I had a lot of resentment with my parents about, you know, I was taught to honor my mother and my father. But I had a really hard time with that because my home was violent. And I grew up in a lot of craziness, a lot of hitting, a lot of screaming and yelling. My mom has since discovered, you know, that she's a diabetic and a sugar addict. And we found out that she was sneaking food. Every Sunday night we'd wake up to cabinets slamming and pots banging, and she'd be fighting with my dad, and if any of us got in the way, we'd get hit. And she has since discovered, you know, that was her addiction, and what she'd been doing was she'd been sneaking food. Saturday night was her worst eating night. She'd be up all night eating entire cheesecakes and things like that, and she'd be strung out on sugar Sunday morning. And that was part of her, you know, reaction, her alcoholism. And that was really helpful to find that out. But my nickname growing up I had two nicknames, Stupid Ass and Bad Seed. And that was another important part of working that inventory on my parents, because I had to learn that I was not a stupid ass and I was not a bad seed. And what had happened is that even though I was now several thousand miles away from my parents, I had carried on calling myself that. And whenever something bad would happen, I'd tell myself I was a stupid ass and I was a bad seed and that nothing good would come of me. And that's why I couldn't have good relationships, and that's why I couldn't make things work in my life, and that's why I really just was a piece of shit. And that's basically how I felt about myself. And doing that inventory was the beginning of my undoing that belief system. I met a guy in AA and got married in my, fifth or sixth year. And we ended up moving to Israel. And I lived in Israel for 2 years. And in Israel, the meetings were mostly in Hebrew. And they were not big on the 12 traditions, and the meetings were really small, and it was very frustrating. But NA had a small group of people that were trying to put a program together. And they were a little more open, so I got really involved in NA over there. And that's where I learned to speak Hebrew. By the time I left Israel, it was right around my birthday, and I gave my pitch in Hebrew before I left there. So that was like an incredible experience. We translated the basic text of NA, and we translated the AA service manual into Hebrew so that they could put a program together. And it was just an unbelievable experience. We started with, I think we had about 2 or 3 meetings a week only in Tel Aviv, and by the time I left there were meetings in like the four corners of Israel, and they were meeting even on the Sabbath when there's no public transportation. And I just went back there a year ago at Passover and walked into the room, and there must have been 200 people in the room, and I walked in and I'm like the mother of NA there, you know. And they all broke into song, singing this, you know, real Middle Eastern song, and it was just this incredible experience. So, again, you know, if I had known on that first night when they asked me, what do you picture will happen to you when you get sober, I mean, I sure didn't have any idea that it would be about this. Part of being married was that my husband had a little boy that I also fell in love with, and this little boy, his name is Seth. He was this magical kid, and I was very, very attached to him. And what happened is that the marriage ended, and it ended while we were in Israel. And it was real painful because I wanted to just stay married just so I could stay with Seth, because I just loved this kid. And it was the hardest thing to try to figure out, you know, what to do to take care of me. My husband really was more interested in his students than he was in being married. And, you know, it was just the hardest decision to leave him. And it was so painful. And it kind of, even now when I talk about it, it's hard to talk about it because it feels kind of like surgery without anesthesia. Because we really bonded. And having to give him up, you know, to let go and you know, split up, and then we were all going to live in the same area, we were all going to move back to America and live in the same area so that I wouldn't be separated from Seth. And then I moved here to LA, and Seth was in Tel Aviv with his dad, and he was going to come out in the summertime. And what happened is the Infitada started, the Arab uprising started, and so his dad sent Seth to live with me. So here I thought I had lost everything, and I was renting this room with kitchen privileges in L.A. I had, like, no money. I moved here with $400. I knew 4 people in L.A., and I didn't have a job yet. I didn't have wheels. And one of the people, I had written letters to the 4 people I knew in L.A. before I left Israel saying, this is what's going on. I'm in a lot of pain. I'm really screwed up. It's been 11 years since I've lived on the American mainland. I'm going to need help. So just when I get there, will you help me? And when I got, one of them set up, my sponsor had set up a place for me to live, this room. When I got there, I called another guy, and I called him up the weekend I got to L.A., and he said, oh, I've been waiting for you to call so I could bring your car over to you. And I'm like, what? And he said, well, a funny thing happened, and by circumstances, I have an extra car, and you may as well use it because you can't get around this town without a car. So the next thing I know, I had a car, and a few months later, he said, you know, I want you to take this car and trade it in. You need a new car. You know, when I started working and everything. That's another one of those things that you guys just have provided for me along the way. And anyway, so I moved to L.A., and then Bob sent Seth to me. And it was this miracle because I had left Seth feeling so terrible, thinking that he's going to think that it was something about him, you know, that I was leaving him. You know, kids think that. And I got to have this time with Seth. It was just he and I. I had no money. I had just started working. But we had this time together, you know. I had a twin bed, and I took the mattress off, and he slept on the mattress, and I slept on the box spring, and it was just this crazy. I don't know how I did it. He's blind, and he needed special schooling, and I somehow got him into schooling and into child care, and all this stuff just happened. And I think it was so that God could put us together one last time, just the two of us, so that we would know, he would know, that it was, that my relationship with him could not be broken. And what ended up happening was his father moved back to L.A. and then decided that he just didn't want to stay in L.A. and they moved to the East Coast. So it was really a painful thing to lose Seth, because I was used to it. I'd had him for 5 years, you know, from age 3 to 8, you know, making his oatmeal every morning and putting him to bed every night and all that stuff, and then to have to let go. And I told you, letting go has been my biggest lesson, and it's the hardest thing for me. And I still talk to him all the time. He calls us every weekend, and I see him every couple of months and all that. But it's been a real painful thing to not have him daily in my life. But my life is none of my business, and I do have a relationship with him, and I guess that's the relationship that I'm supposed to have with him right now. And I ended up coming here, and the very first person I had met when I went to Israel was this woman named Ruthie. And Ruthie had a brother, and I met her brother and all that stuff while I was in Israel. And he had moved here a couple months ahead of me. And when I moved back here, she said, you know, you should look up my brother. You know, you guys would be good friends. So we did. We got together a few times and that kind of thing. But I was pretty much of a mess. I was newly divorced and all that. And anyway, what happened was a year later, we would see each other once in a while. A year later, Ruthie calls me. She's in town. I said, what are you doing in town? She said, my brother's had this horrible accident. And what's going on? And, oh, okay. What did I do? I'm bad. It's still there, you know. Thank you for sharing. So anyway, he had had a terrible accident, and she was in town, and she ended up staying with me, and there was this whole thing that happened, and that's Larry. Larry had this accident. They told us that better get to the hospital that night because he wasn't going to live through the night. And by some miracle, he survived, and all this stuff happened, and I was running back and forth to the hospital, and the family was from the East Coast and from Israel, and I was the only one out here, and all this stuff started happening. And anyway, he went back east for rehab, and he came back out here, and we got married a year and a half ago. So, you know, you just don't know what's going to happen. I mean, maybe I went to Israel with my first husband so that I could meet Larry, you know, and maybe I went to work on a stroke unit those many years ago so that I could learn how to be around people who were paralyzed on one side. And I don't know. There was just so many things like that in my life that continue to happen. This year I completed another dream. You know, Dave was telling you I completed my doctorate in psychology this year. And that's been an incredible dream. I have a wonderful practice with a lot of you guys are in it, and it's really a wonderful thing to, you know, to look at all that stuff we get to look at now that we're sober, and, you know, all that stuff that comes up that we maybe forgot. And my life is incredibly full now. I wish I could even describe it for you, but it's hard. It's like, I just have these wonderful moments and wonderful things that happen. I'm back into my sports, and I swim in the ocean every weekend, and where I swim there are dolphins, and they swim right along with me. And you know, I go for these gorgeous bike rides on Pacific Coast Highway, and I feel really good, and I have work I love, and I have people I have love in my life. I'm married to someone who really loves me, and I let him. That's a miracle, because I didn't know how to let people love me. I knew how to keep people away. I didn't know how to let you in. And I didn't know that I was worthy of being loved. I'm learning more about letting go and how to do that. And I'm learning about self-respect and dignity. And that's an important part of being clean and sober for me. So I just, you know, this is a field of dreams, you know, being here. And if you just stay sober, work the steps, have a sponsor, you know, and just sit here. And even when you don't know it, it somehow works. So thank you very much for letting me be here tonight.